Hello, this is Josh Carr with The Real Angle, and today I'm speaking with Brian Wilson, Managing Director of Real Estate at Bow River Capital. Brian, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Josh. Thank you for having me.
Cool. Thank you for joining. This is good. I wanted to get you on. I thought it would be exciting to talk about your company's strategies. And one thing I always like to say before we even get started for those on the internet, because invariably if I don't say it, someone asks. Company's Bow River Capital, bowrivercapital.com. That's how you'll find them. Just wanted to get that out of the way.
Thank you.
Sure. So let's start with the basics. How long have you been at Bow River? What do you do there? That sort of stuff.
Yeah, you bet. So I'm actually just coming up on my year with Bow River. I've been a friend of the firm for probably a decade now. Their funds had invested in deals that I ran at other organizations. And thought there was a great opportunity here to come help deploy and manage the current fund, which is Fund 3, a $450 million full discretionary fund that we raised in November of 21. So I joined in January of 2023. As you mentioned, I am a managing director of the real estate platform. As a company, we have five separate platforms, real estate being one of them. We also have software as a service. We have the typical private equity buyout platform. We have an evergreen platform. And then most recently, in early 2023, we raised a private equity credit platform, non-real estate focused. So myself and my colleague, Pat Blaisdell, run the real estate platform.
And the company started as a real estate company, though, right? It started from the real estate side of the universe. So to speak.
It did. Our founder and CEO, Blair Richardson, he was very successful in previous careers with, you know, Morgan Stanley, groups like that, but had a real estate background. And the firm, I would say, did start out on the first funds were in the real estate part of the world, and then grew the firm as Blair is, you know, extremely smart and strategic in thinking. And having five various platforms versus just one adds significant value to our asset management company from a bottom line and diversification, being able to work with a large set of investors and LPs that have different goals, whether it's wealth preservation or, you know, trying to grow wealth in the earlier stages.
And logically, if they want to invest in one strategy, maybe they'd be open to strategy number two, three, and four. As long as you're,
we love it when the LPs come in across all the platforms. That's for sure. And
yeah,
there's
cross-selling. I mean, it's the name of the game with it. All financial institutions are about, if as long as you're getting an auto loan, would you like a credit card? Not to
that's right.
Not to trivialize it, but cross-selling.
Yes.
I get that. I get that. So yeah. So and that gets to, I mean, you're fund managers. You're not directly running the asset, correct? You're working with local operators and that sort of thing.
We are. We do a bit of both. Our strategy is 50% direct deals and 50% with a GP.
Okay.
So it depends. I am a heavy background in operations through my career. So I am an operator at heart. Mm-hmm. And we're probably if we're partnered with a GP and everything's hitting business plan, we will let the GP continue to execute and perform.
Right.
If we're struggling, then we will get involved on the operation side with the GP, really just because we have a lot of value that we can add in that. Doing our own direct deals, of course, we have extensive experience in operating assets. But personally, for me at my level, it's really more of managing the fund as a fund manager versus pulling the levers on a day-to-day basis on each asset.
Not knocking on doors, collecting rent. No, I hear you. I hear you.
No, and even when we do that, you know, we do have third-party property management companies. When I'm saying we're operators, it's really from an asset management standpoint. And I grew up in the third-party operator world, so I know that business very well, and I know how to work with that side of the business, having been in it, on how to maximize value and get the best out of our operating partners, whether that be a GP or a property management company.
And I'm glad you're drilling down on this, because one thing, you know, I think a lot of people, frankly, are sloppy in their terms. You know, you've got property management, you've got asset management, you've got fund management, sort of working from the knocking on the door up to, you know, deployment of capital.
Sure.
And a lot of people I find just sort of blend these terms together, not really thinking about sort of the layers and where you're adding value and what have you. So fund management, asset management all makes sense. But I'd say, and you're relatively regionally focused, correct? In terms of
we are regionally focused. We operate in what we've coined the rodeo region.
I saw that on your website. I thought that was a pithy way of saying it. Realizing there is a bison behind you.
Yes, there is.
Watching the video, not listening, not a live bison, a picture of a bison. I want to clarify.
Right.
He doesn't have a bison. So
the rodeo region, you know, as we look at that, it's comprised of 14 states, you know, north, south borders of the country. And so the western border is going to be Idaho, Nevada, Arizona. The eastern border is going to be the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, down to Texas. And then obviously the states in the middle, New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. So that is the area that we focus most of our business in. We have the ability to invest outside of that region, but we really try to, we understand those markets the best. We understand what's happening in those markets from a macro standpoint, and we've had great performance there, and the region has continued to outperform some of the coastal markets, middle market type investments for us.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because I talk to people, international players, and I think there's a real bias with international players towards, you know, the coastal cities. I often find, I think when I talk to them, that it seems to be driven more by like where they go on vacation more than rational. They're just like, well,
yep,
I go to Miami because it's sunny. I go to New York because it has museums and shows. And then I say, what about Chicago? And not to beat up on Chicago, because I don't think any European tourist has ever gone to Chicago. It's just not on their list of cities to hit.
We see a lot from institutional, international money. It's almost, if they haven't heard of the city and know about it, they're probably not investing in it. And right, I think what the rodeo region allows us to do, other than really understand, everything's a fairly quick flight for us being based in Denver. So travel, we're not spending time on planes going coast to coast or things of that nature. But it just allows us to really dial down, focus on what we know, and actually be a little bit more competitive without the bigger institutions chasing this lower middle market type investments. And a lot of times staying on the coast or in the core plus cities. And we'll do anything from, you know, Salt Lake to Ogden, tertiary, secondary markets. We'll play in those markets. Less competition, less capital chasing deals, less chances of them getting bid up, although there's a lot of capital on the sideline right now, so that's a challenge everywhere.
And that's a funny thing. I mean, you know, first off, just to sort of close that point, is I'd say, and you're still deploying a $450 million fund. So, I mean, this is not jump change by any means. I mean, fine, you're not Blackstone and you're not doing a gazillion, but I mean, it's still institutional by all means. And that gets to the question about the capital on the sidelines. I mean, you know, we're recording this in early January, and all the conversations I had pre the holidays were, well, in 24, everyone will start deploying money. And obviously, you know, we're beginning of January, so I'm not saying it happens the day after New Year's. But I mean, what's your sense? There's a huge amount of capital sitting on the sidelines. If you had to put a pin in it, when do you think the money legitimately starts to get out there? Like, or put another way, what is everybody waiting for? Like, what is the sign from the heavens that tells people now is the time to get back in?
Yeah, I think the obvious answer there, Josh, is, you know, some relief in the capital markets in terms of, you know, rate reduction. I think we've seen the Fed signaling they're looking to lower. I have concerns outside of that. My view is that this is, with where debt has gone, and I would actually tell you that the rates, while a problem and expensive, the bigger issue is the deleveraging and not being able to get that 65-60%. You know, we've seen term sheets in the 50s and the high 40s, you know, with banks pulling back. On top of that, they want, you know, 10 to 20% of loan balance in deposits. So it's almost like you're borrowing a decent amount of your own money.
Like, if you give the money, I'll just deploy it as equity.
So I think a lot of the market will wait for rates as soon as they drop, maybe start to drop in March, and they may go in. I think it's a false sense of security, at least in the multifamily sector. As I'm looking at it, phase one of devaluation was certainly due to the capital markets, interest rates, not being able to get the amount of debt leverage you need to hit your returns. But I think the second phase, and at least in the multifamily space, is the fundamentals, the market fundamentals are declining. And so we'll be very disciplined in terms of deploying capital in 2024. I think for us, it would be nice if we could catch one deal in the first half of 2024. I think we'll see more of it open up in the latter half of 2024 and then really into 2025. I think there will be groups buying ahead of us, but I think they're going to miss on the fundamentals. And I think the fundamentals, I think we're only probably in this maybe the third or fourth inning of the fundamentals. You can see the data. Occupancy is dropping. Rent growth is nominal, flat, negative in some markets. And then what everyone else is talking about is there is a glutton of supply coming for apartments at record levels, 24 and into 25. So for us, deploying of capital, we will not deploy capital into a highly supply coming market such as a Phoenix, Austin, Salt Lake, Denver. You will not see us deploy capital into those markets, certainly not in the first half of 2024.
No, and that's interesting. I mean, I'm based in New Jersey, so I mean, we're land constrained. So, and not that we don't have supply, but it's not the same kind of extreme. There was building, but there wasn't like building like drunken sailors. I mean, it was crazy, some of the construction that went up in some of these markets.
And you're right. It's certainly, you can't really invest on a national thesis because every market is so different. I mean, you can look at Midland, for example, that's been on a tear. That's really an oil play more than anything. You can look at Madison, Wisconsin, who's seen high single digits, not a lot of new supply coming.
Right. So
I like the supply. This is when I like to buy, is when things get pushed down and are tough. And you're buying, you know, at a, what you think is near the bottom or off the bottom. I don't think we're there yet, and I'm nervous to buy a little bit too early. Others will pile in earlier than me. I call it
they'll get it maybe, and then it'll come back up again. Yeah.
Yep, and it will. I mean, it will come up, but for me, it's if I can buy, cap rates really haven't moved in apartments like we thought they would, certainly with, you know, fundamentals slipping and then the capital markets. And so I think that we'll be able to buy. We've run the numbers. It'll be smarter for us to buy on the back end of this year and early into 25 than early on. I think there's going to be enough deals out there for us to win and be awarded. And we're just very patient and very disciplined. And we've taken this approach. It's been very painful. We bought one apartment deal, multifamily deal, one deal total on the real estate platform in all of 2023. And it was a very unique deal. And it made sense for us, but it is looking at a lot of deals. It's mostly market discovery, figuring out where the bid ask gap is. Is it getting closer? And then trying to structure offers that really help the seller. So it's really important to me to understand the motivation behind the seller so I can create an offer that will hopefully solve their problems and not be the highest price.
Well, yeah, and that gets to, it's not always just about price, right? It's terms, and it's, you know, are we doing something weird with, you know, assuming debt or taking back paper, like all the different variations of things that one can do. Because, you've got, you know, it's an interesting situation where you've got a lot of buyers who are in trouble basically because of term defaults. I mean, or certain current owners who are in trouble because the debt is matured. It's not that they did anything wrong. You know, they weren't bad managers. It's just simply the bank that used to give them 70 LTV only wants to now give them 60, and rates went up a bunch, you know?
Yeah.
Building's the same.
It's the opposite of what us real estate guys, you know, want to see. When we refinance an asset, we're usually used to taking cash out,
right?
The norm today is it's probably a cash-in refi. And in some cases on the deals that we've tracked, the cash-in to refi is actually more capital than they actually have in the deal today.
Right.
And so
like
I think
you're
to your point,
a second time, essentially.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And to your point of it's not always about the best price. I think we're not there yet, but we will get to a point here probably in the next 6 months where I think sellers will be looking for over best price surety of close because they have these maturity walls coming. The smart ones have already been selling or trying to sell their assets now. But as they get closer to those maturity walls, they're not going to have the luxury of taking the highest and best price, maybe through a syndicator, for example, who sure. can't raise the capital to close. So I think that's the one thing we sell at Bow River is, you know, we are working with the $450 million fund. We've deployed, even though we have not bought anything of significance in the last 18 months, we have deployed roughly 50% of that fund. And that was in late 21 and early 22,
okay.
mostly in the industrial space, very yeah. heavy on the industrial space. And our strategy for the current fund is very narrow. It's, we call it beds and sheds. It's either multifamily or it's industrial. So, I think the original plan was thinking maybe 60% of the fund would be industrial, 40% multi, and we're probably at 10% multi right now and the remaining 40% industrial. So it'll be a heavy multi push for the remaining 2 years.
I want to ask something on that. I'm sorry, just because I'm curious. So, you know, usually when I see a fund, they say we're doing hotels in the Southeast. You know, we're doing industrial in the Northwest, or maybe it's industrial nationally. It's interesting to me that your fund basically had a dual strategy of apartments and industrial in this region. What was the pitch? Like, what was the logic of putting those two together rather than just saying it's a pure multi or a pure industrial fund?
Well, I think industrial has been on a tear of late, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, and so it was basically a supply and demand fundamentals and researching and looking at that, kind of the last mile, if you will, on great located industrial projects. Mostly of what we've done is actually developed the industrial. We have not bought a lot of existing industrial. So the money that's been deployed thus far is very heavy in industrial development. And while I do think we are seeing a softening there, there's no supply on the horizon. And really the only softening that we're seeing is we used to be able to develop these things and get a forward sale at CO, right?
Sure.
That buyer has gone away and it makes sense, right, with where the capital markets are. The other thing I would say on the tenant side is they are now taking longer to make a decision and they are waiting for buildings to be done versus, you know, 18 months ago, 12 months ago, we were seeing a lot of pre-leasing being done. So the space is still getting absorbed, but it's just slower. In all of our underwriting, I mean, we had a minimum of 12 months of stabilization, if not 18 to 24 in a lot of them. So we feel very comfortable there. On the apartment side, the thesis there was we knew that a lot of units were being built. We knew apartments had been on a massive tear. Rent growth was just absolutely insane. And so we know, as the classic saying goes, you know, party doesn't last forever. So raising that fund, and probably in hindsight, as you've heard, we haven't deployed a lot of that into the multifamily because, quite honestly, it's gone on a lot. The party has got on a lot longer than I anticipated.
Surprise.
And now we're starting to see that. Obviously, one with the capital markets, which, quite honestly, other than rates going up in early 22, we started hedging bets on development deals. Rates are going to go up. Things are going to get tough. Construction costs were just crazy at that point. Massive escalation, very hard to predict. And now we have now we're in phase two, what I call is phase two, is where the fundamentals are declining. It's just affordability is an issue. So we thought there was going to be large opportunity. I think we were smart and disciplined and captured that opportunity as fast as we could after closing the fund in the industrial space. And we're smart enough to say, we're not buying in late 21 or 22. And we can debate where the peak was. I think a lot of the research data firms say the peak was March of 22. I tend to think it was fourth quarter of 21, but
he's
very close
at that point.
Either
yeah.
way.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've seen that, and we've seen some deals that were bought in that 21, late 21 vintage and early 22 vintage, portfolio of four deals we were just looking at. That's not even worth the debt balance on it. You know, it was still very high. A lot of debt funds were in place. 85% leverage. People were still underwriting significant rent growth going forward. And we had a different view. We were looking at, we're never going with a fund up to 85%. We're trying to stay in at 60, 65% so we can sleep at night.
Right.
But the fundamentals were the bigger issue when we were looking at what our colleagues were underwriting. For example, in the fourth quarter of 21, while I was not with the firm, I was actually contacted by the firm to partner with them on apartments through my own company. And I just said, you guys can't buy this stuff now. This is what things are trading for. This is what the rent growth assumptions are. I said, this is going to be bad news. And they listened and shut it down. And so we positioned ourselves well. So now we are in a good position. And of course, we've got, 2 years left on our investment period, the right to extend the third year, which we don't want to do. So we're now strategically trying to look at how does that capital deployment lay out over the next 24 and 25. And I think it's going to be heavier back ended and starting in, as I mentioned, late 24 and in 25, I think it'll be, an arms race, if you will, to buy deals.
That all makes sense. Yeah. And it is, look, sometimes the best deals you do are the deals you don't do. I mean, without naming names, I know of a large institutional transaction, which one group got heavily outbid. And I knew the guy who ran the deal team, and they'd spent like months working on this thing, and they got outbid by so much that they were happy that they got outbid by that much.
And so
the joke was, supposedly they took the team, they went out for dinner. You know, when you do a big deal, you get like the Lucite block with the name of the deal on it. And the team leader, as a joke, basically handed out to all the members blank Lucite blocks, like to celebrate the fact that they weren't that stupid. Pay by 30%.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said for that. I mean, it's it's going to be interesting to see as we get into 24, how many players get back into it. Now, you did mention development. So obviously on the development stuff, that you are probably working with an operator, because I assume with construction, someone's signing guarantees and you're a fund. So that's probably not you, if I had to guess.
You're dead on there, Josh. Where we will not do direct deals is on the development side of things. While I have a lot of development experience, we're not set up. We don't have the deep bench on development. Development is very tough. It's the riskiest part in real estate, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And we used to do a lot of it at previous firms and in my own company that I started, because you were getting, with the outsized risk, you were getting outsized rewards. And then as returns, everything has come down, it's like, oh man, this is very pedestrian. Now, there's generally still higher returns than buying a stabilized property, but for the amount of risk involved in it, for me personally, it's not worth it.
We have
gone pencils down on development for about 18 months now. Anything that wasn't already started or in the works, all of our development deals, as I mentioned, we do have a GP that is managing and running those deals. That is a very hands-on business, in my opinion. We need people on the site. We need people that understand the construction of it. We're not equipped to do it. So there's an example of where we would 100% JV with a GP and partner with them to run the development deals. If it's stabilized or if it's a light rehab, we can handle that internally and we'll do those deals direct.
And out of curiosity, with your operators, like, how are they finding you? How are you finding them? Because finding a good operator, just like finding a good capital source, can be a challenge.
Yeah, some of the best operators we've found have been referrals from existing partners. And I think, my team is relatively young, but I have worked with a lot of great partners and a lot of not great partners. And so you kind of learn. And I'm very sensitive to fees. I'm very sensitive to co-invest.
Right.
I want the partners to put their money where their mouth is. I have no problem paying the promote. I'm looking at if they're making significant fees and they lose all their equity in the deal and they're still fine, that's not a partnership I want to be a part of.
Right.
So it is a very, very strict and diligent process. And like I said, the best ones that we've found have been introductions from people that we know, either we've worked with internally when Bow River or myself or my colleague Pat has worked with in his previous careers. But that is my number one thing. Underwriting the partner or sponsor of the deal, in my opinion, is more important than underwriting the deal itself.
Betting on the jockey, not on the horse, so to speak.
100%. Yep.
Yeah.
No, so we're looking for strong track record. We're looking for market knowledge. We're looking for a cultural fit as well. You know, we're looking at ESG, you know, what else have these guys done? Reputation, you know, when we're obviously have a reputation to, and it may not be something we did, but if we partner with somebody, obviously it could reflect badly on us. So it's, sure, it's a very, very deep dive process.
No, and that's fair. It's fair. You know, it is, it's tricky. I find especially issues of reputation today, you know, so much is so managed in terms of social media and the rest of it, is it's, you know, getting beyond the good looking website and being like, okay, legitimately, who are these people? You know?
Yeah.
And I'm always,
well, I,
maybe it's just my bias. No, I was just going to say, I've always been fascinated by looking at, you know, the stories of the big fraudsters, the Madoffs of the world, and understanding, yep, you know, how did they do it? And it's always interesting looking at the operators who are just pure smoke and mirrors. And I guess some people never get beyond the smoke and the mirrors. So,
well, and I think it's really important to look at the track record of an operator. If this is, there is a lot of syndicators who recently got into apartments, you know, on the way up while the ladder was rising. And
yeah,
they market made them look like geniuses. I'm looking for someone that's been through the cycles, the ups, the downs. They survived the GFC. Right. Because if you're looking at a short span and it's just a flash in the pan, and it may be the market that made their returns great and not necessarily the, yep, individuals that you're partnering with. So that is probably one of the biggest things I looked at. I got a lot of gray hairs. You can see I'm looking for other folks that have gray hair and scar tissue, at least at the top, scar tissue being most important.
No, I hear you. I hear you. I mean, look, you know, there's, you know, the cycles are relatively long. And so it takes a long time to, yep, see what the good day looks like and the bad day looks like. And there's nothing for that other than to just be kicking around for a while and to see, okay, this is what an out of control market looks like.
Yep.
And this is where it looks really bad, you know?
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing. Like on one hand, what we're going through right now is not good, but it's not like financial crisis of 08 bad. I mean, you know, it's understanding, okay, this is a dip. This isn't like, you know, major financial institutions blow up end of the world type stuff.
Yep.
But you know, but it's an issue. It's a buying opportunity, right? You know,
it is. And I mean, I think we're in an environment. I tell the young team members that we have here is these are the times when you will actually learn the most and define your career, because you are now getting scar tissue from being associated with assets, whether it's asset management, trying to deploy capital, you know, things of that nature. Is this is what makes real estate professionals the best, having gone through this. We're in a time where you have to work five times as hard to make the same return,
right,
as you can in a normal market. In a great market, you don't have to work at all. You just got to have the capital, deploy it right, and kick back and watch. So these are the times, I want to work with partners who have been through these times, who think outside the box, who get very creative, because that's what it requires to be successful when you move into distressed markets or on the downswing right now. I think the other thing with the younger folks too, is I use this a lot. It takes so much longer to get to the bottom of a cycle than people realize. And that's why you see a lot of early buys, false buys, right? And it's very hard to time the bottom. So, you know, what I tell them is we kind of take the stairs down, and then the recoveries, I use the term a hockey stick effect. They're, yeah, not like this. They are like this.
Then it's everybody. And, yeah. It's
and the only reason I know that is because I've made those mistakes earlier in my career where I didn't buy opportunities because I was way too conservative on the recovery. And then I look at all these deals I passed on in my 30s and what they would have been. And it's like, okay. I know how that works.
And you see that with neighborhoods when neighborhoods come back, and once an area is hot and it starts to gentrify, it can go up in value a heck of a lot quicker than it declined. Yeah.
That's no, right.
It's interesting. I mean, your point, which I think is really excellent, is that things do not go up and go down at the same rate. there is a disconnect. It does tend to go up a lot faster than it goes down. I think
absolutely
what was sort of shocking about the 08 crisis, and I think why we all kind of had a heart attack when it happened, was that was one of the cases where things just moved very quickly and they collapsed overnight. You know, it was like
significantly.
And that was shocking because our industry doesn't work that way. Our industry generally, you can see the train coming a year away. You can see okay, rents are dropping. This tenant's probably going to move out, you know, and you see it. I'm not saying you can do anything about it. Sometimes you can't because, you know, the wave is bigger than the boat sometimes, but like, at least you can see it. Whereas other crises, you know, it's instantaneous.
Yeah. And you said it. I think what our group is very good at is we do see it well in advance in a lot earlier, I think, than others do. So when we're in that, okay, yeah. This was, you know, when I joined in January of 2023 with the firm, I was asked to give a macro presentation of what I thought apartments were going to do. Sure. And people kind of looked at me and thought I was crazy. But here we are, you know, a year later, and all of that is happening. Now, it doesn't always happen that way. I mean, right. I've been wrong a ton of times.
But you see it.
You know that, you know, construction costs, you know, were erratic. Maybe they're stabilizing. They're certainly not going down, in my view. The debt, you know, in 2022, we were under contract with my company on some development deals in Summit County, vacation type home for sale property. We walked from all of our contracts in 2022 because we thought that the debt was going up. We thought there was a potential recession coming. And the first thing that doesn't move in the recession is second homes in the mountains.
Right. No one's buying a vacation home. Yeah.
And so we walked away from those. So seeing things early is important. If you're right directionally, as we have been, then the pain is the next 12 to 18 months waiting for the opportunity to come back, especially when you're sitting on a lot of capital that needs to be deployed.
And the timing of when you raise money is tricky that way. It is tricky.
It is.
If you raise much money, people gave you those commitments because they expected you to deploy it.
Yep.
And that's, which is not an unreasonable expectation, which is why investors are always like, what's your pipeline? Let me understand that you can realistically deploy this in the time needed. So let me flip it around and just ask a question, which is off of what you usually do. You do a lot of apartments. Your colleague does a lot of industrial. That's the focus. What kind of investments do you think are out there right now, which are interesting investments, but you can't make because you're doing apartments and industrial? Are there other sectors that you think are kind of curious?
You know, I think retail's a bit curious. You know, I mean, we will not touch office or even use that word here in our firm.
Well, office is a dirty word at this point. It's HR will call you in if you use that word in the office.
That's exactly right. And there's a lot of pain still to be felt there. And we've been talking about this office collapse for 2 years now, and that's, I think, a point of how long it takes to work through the system to going down. But you know, there's interesting retail buys out there. I would say the other area that would interest me if we had this in our strategy is single tenant A credit investments, whether it's office or industrial or things of that nature,
sure.
Right? Where you've got A plus, you know, tenant credit in there and you know that check's coming. Now you're not going to be hitting, you know, 25 IRRs and things of that nature, but it's a very risk adjusted, safe bet, boring, mind you, but to deploy capital, you know, it's almost like a guaranteed check coming in if you can get the investment
right.
grade. So I think those are very good investments right now.
And if you're a family office.
They
good yield, long term. It's about wealth preservation. It's about transferring wealth to the next generation. Yeah, no, the net lease strategy is, or the long term lease strategy is definitely interesting. I think the big question there is, you know, even stuff that's credit rated like retail, I just wonder long term what retail is even going to look like, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one thing that I've done in previous life in the career is we were buying retail and it was, you know, the Amazon effect. What are you guys buying retail? But the retail we were focusing on was service oriented businesses, right? You know, whether that be a dentist or attorneys or, you know, dry cleaners, things like that, that you can't get online and just click and have show up at your door. So
nail salons, you know, I get it.
Yeah. You know, so it's creative thinking like that. You know, I tell you the other opportunity, we haven't seen a lot of these, but we're starting to see a couple, is I have actually come across a couple multifamily deals that I like, but they fall really more into a income fund vehicle than our value add. Buying them, longer term holds, good cash flow, good underwriting. We're in the strike zone, but we don't have enough time in our fund to really hit that big value.
Right, because you're
a fund. We're a fund and we're looking for opportunistic and value add type investments. Aside from that, we do some subordinate debt, very small checks. These are $2 to $4 million checks, and they are for really boutique home builders that need to fill that capital gap, the gap in the capital stack. And those have actually worked out fairly well, primarily because those aren't big multiple returns. I mean, they're typically 1.3, 1.4 returns. The thought process for us is we can get in, get out, and recycle it and go into another one. And so we've been active in that space with some of these boutique home builders, and it's worked out well because the loans have been out a lot longer, not because they can't sell their homes, but the entitlement process was so much longer than anybody anticipated. And so the juice is continuing to run. So we're seeing returns on those deals in multiple wise into the 1.6 to 1.8 range, which is very appealing from that type of platform. And the homes are actually still selling. They're not selling at a big clip, but the fundamentals there are okay. And pricing really in the markets that we participate in has not seen a big decline. It's just slower. It's a normalized market, probably, if you will. That's even in the high rate interest environment that we've been in. So we've done a little bit of that, but I would say those are the deals minus the sub platform that are outside of our strategy that I would be looking at is potentially some service centered retail, credit, single tenant, net leasing, you know, things of that nature. But safe, you know.
No, I always like to ask because it's, you know, we all have our thing we do, but at the same time, you know, that doesn't mean we don't see that there might be other value in other things.
Sure.
Other flavors of product. I always think of it in terms of film. Like, I like horror movies. I like science fiction, but that doesn't mean I can't appreciate a romantic comedy. It's just not normally what I sit down and watch.
Yep.
You know, such is life.
Sure. Yep.
Well, look, this has been very constructive. It's good to go through these things. You know, honestly, I kind of went through with you what I wanted to, which was to talk about the apartment market and where we are and where we're going. I think the big question for me and for you, and I think for a lot of people listening in, is just what will 24 look like and when do we all hear the starting gun and that sort of stuff. It's definitely interesting to get an additional perspective on it. So
thanks for having me. I think the starting gun will be March with the initial rate cut by the feds. We'll see if that happens that early, but I think that's it. And I think you'll see some folks move. But as I mentioned earlier, I'm really focusing on the fundamentals and I think they're declining.
Well,
and our underwrites need to take that into account. And we're not buying and underwriting 3-4% rent growth in year one or two. We're underwriting flat rents. And I hope that's conservative enough in some of these markets, because we've certainly seen rents go negative in several markets across the country.
It's going to be interesting. Well, look, thanks again. And for those listening, again, this is Josh Carr. I was speaking with Brian Wilson, Managing Director of Real Estate at Bow River Capital. And you can check them out at bowrivercapital.com. Thanks again, Brian. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.